Facebook, and Retrospect 60s Garage Punk on Instagram. And for back episodes, find Retrospect 60s Garage Punk Show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and lots more great podcasting platforms.
A tragedy, horrible tragedy, worst in our country's history, a horror show.
Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.
Well, I'm terribly frightened of the problem of LSD. I think there's been a great deal of misinformation by those who seem to see no harm in it. But as a parent and as a citizen, certainly now in this position, I am greatly concerned. There is nothing smart. There's nothing grown up or sophisticated in taking an LSD trip at all. They're just being complete fools. Anyone would engage in this or indulge in this is just a plain fool.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Cataraqui on Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee land.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
G'day and welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if you may miss the show any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcasts. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, I would like to introduce you to Jayla Chet, who is doing a Master's in Translational Medicine under the supervision of Dr. Gord Boyd. Welcome to Grad Chat, Jayla.
Hi, welcome.
So before we actually talk about your research per se, just to let everyone know, I really first got to know you during the three-minute thesis competition. And I must say, if you want someone enthusiastic, it's Jayla, and always looking at ways to improve on anything that she's done, which is brilliant for someone who's going into research. So the good news is, you know, 3-minute thesis that you did was 3 minutes. I'm going to give you 29, so I'm going to give you lots of time to help explain the kind of work that you're doing, which is why you went through the translational medicine program. So for everyone, you're probably waiting for me to tell you what she does. The research topic is personalizing blood pressure targets in the ICU to improve survivor cognitive outcomes. Now, I have a lot of questions there, even just from that topic, because we've got blood pressure. Are they at the right levels? We're in the ICU, looking at the patient and their cognitive outcomes. So there seems to be a lot going on there. So do you want to give us, first of all, just an overview of what you're studying and why? What was the initial problem, or what made you get into this particular side of research?
Yeah, so the broad area of this research, we're looking at cognitive outcomes of patients. So we're looking at neuroscience. Okay. And this is something that I've always had an interest growing up. I always be fascinated about the brain and what are essential elements for a healthy and functional brain. And I think this interest was really consolidated in high school, where I volunteered for a long-term care home. And okay. I worked with a lot of seniors who experienced cognitive decline. And also my own grandparents are at the age where they experience memory problem, attention problems. And it turned this interest into advocacy.
Right.
Something that I want to do so I can empower people and making sure that they don't have to suffer and they have better quality of life. And in the end of my undergraduate study, I saw this research by my supervisor looking at cognitive impairment ICU survivor. It's not a population that I had a lot of experience with.
Right.
But after reading more about their lived experience, they're actually very highly impacted by cognitive impairment. Up to 40% of ICU survivors experience some sort of cognitive impairment.
Is that right?
Yeah.
It's a lot, isn't it?
It's a lot. And 30% is equivalent to those who have mild Alzheimer. And
right.
These are people who had no problem before they got admitted to the ICU. And that can be very traumatic and very devastating impact on the quality of life, because you think, you know, you survived the ICU stay.
Yes.
And you're done, you know, back to normal. I need to go back to work to support my family. I need to, you know, go enjoy my retirement life by going traveling. But people are haunted by the cognitive impairment they endure after the ICU for years. And it just feels like your critical illness never left. You never fully recover. And that can be very devastating. And that's what essentially motivated me to continue to pursue this research and be there to find a solution to this problem.
So you're talking about people in the ICU. So they've had some sort of trauma. It could have been a car accident, a swimming accident, something that has made it critical for them to be into hospital.
Exactly. Like, vehicle accidents are a reason for why people get admitted to the ICU. Like, vehicle crash trauma. Other big reasons are cardiac arrest.
Right, right.
A sudden heart attack. Or big surgeries, if you need to get a heart transplant.
Right.
You need to get a significant organ transplant.
So people are going in for instance, an organ transplant or a smashed up leg and things. How are those injuries, being in the ICU, affecting the brain or the cognitive functioning?
That's the exact question that we're trying to answer with our research. Is we couldn't puzzle for a long time why something that affects a different organ system would also have an effect on the brain. And a potential answer to that is oxygen level of the brain while patients are in a coma state. So when patients are in a coma state, there are not many ways to understand what exactly is going on in their brain.
Right.
And they're in a coma state, because we can't ask them questions like, are you doing okay?
Right.
And that's most cognitive assessments are behavioral. But there's technology that's been developed. And the technology that we use for our research, called near-infrared spectroscopy, is a type of oximeter that sends wavelengths and lights into your deep brain tissues.
Okay.
And seeing how much oxygen level there is in these tissue. And using that research, we found that patients with low cerebral oxygen level is associated with delirium and other outcomes.
Okay, so they're not getting enough oxygen to the brain.
They're not getting enough oxygen to the brain. And also the ability of the brain to make sure it does get enough oxygen is oftentimes impaired in these patients.
Right, and why would it be impaired in these patients at the time? That's what you're trying to figure out?
This is what we're trying to figure out with a study. We're in our ICU. We're taking different metrics. So, like, we're taking their carbon dioxide value in their blood. We're taking their blood pressure. We're taking their demographic characteristics. And we're trying to look at all these factors and then doing statistical analysis to see what exactly is predicting dysfunction.
So when people in the ICU now, mm-hmm. You often see people getting the oxygen mask. I know myself, and I've been in hospital, you get the oxygen mask and sometimes the little tubes up your nose to make sure that oxygen is flowing, et cetera, et cetera. How do they know what levels to do? And is this part of the problem? Because you talked about there's a lack of oxygen getting into the brain. So is it something else, or is it we're not feeding enough oxygen while they're in the ICU, when, for instance, they could be in a coma and things like that? They're hoping the body's going to do it for them. Whereas sometimes when we're alive, I know it's an automatic system to breathe and everything, but maybe in those states it's not the same. So it needs more help in regulating.
I think this really started with research a few decades before, where there were studies being done to identify this mechanism of the brain that makes sure it gets enough oxygen and blood flow to self-regulate. So the mechanism is called cerebral autoregulation for individuals who are interested. This is the brain's unique protective mechanism to ensure that when there are fluctuations in blood pressure in the body, the brain remains undamaged. For example, when we're exercising, our bodily blood pressure peaks to deliver oxygen and nutrients to the muscles around the body. However, this doesn't affect the blood pressure in the brain because of cerebral autoregulation. Similarly, when we sleep, our blood pressure drops, yet the brain is still not deprived of oxygen or nutrients. This mechanism is always believed to be very powerful. If your blood pressure is above 60, between 60 to like 100 or 120, it's believed that your brain is capable of adjusting this to the right pressure that it needs.
Right.
But what we recently found is that this mechanism is impaired in critically ill patients. And what enabled us to do that, again, is the advancements in technology. We had no way of like assessing oxygen levels in the patient's brain
right.
without actually doing surgical incision of a probe.
Right, which is a bit invasive
and
dangerous.
It's not acceptable for everybody.
Yes.
And so it's very fortunate now that we have non-invasive technology that allows us to identify this problem and now developing a solution to potentially adjust the level of blood pressure and adjust the level of oxygen in the brain to make sure it's optimized and it's at the right amount that it needs.
Because I think if I remember rightly from your 3EMT, up until this point, everyone virtually got the same amount.
Yes.
Which doesn't necessarily work for every person.
Yeah. So most of the medical guidelines recommend keeping individuals' blood pressure above 60 millimeter mercury or 65. And as long as their blood pressure don't fall below that threshold, it is deemed acceptable in the clinical setting. But some people, as we discussed before, may need mm-hmm. a higher blood pressure because of mm-hmm. hypertension or because of other physiology of the brain and the brain
right.
muscles. And it's very important that we have a way of capturing that and making sure that they receive the right blood pressure treatments that they need.
So these little nodes that you put on people, how easy is that? Because one of the things about in an ICU or in a hospital setting in general is that, first of all, if we've got new technologies which can help us, how accessible is it for hospitals to get? How easy is it to use? What kind of training needs to be given? I mean, these all come down to the costs of new technology, which hopefully will be more efficient. But if a hospital can't afford it, then we're going to have some hospitals that have better treatment than others. And really, we should be trying to make sure everyone has equal access to great care.
That's an amazing question. And the story of this research on the brain's capacity to self-regulate in the ICU started with a technology where it's basically a probe where someone needs to hold and have it on the forehead of the individual while they're recording.
Okay.
While they're
right.
recording.
So one person is doing that.
One person is doing that and the person needs to be trained on it. And it was a good assessment of blood flow, but later onwards, there's a lot of question about its visibility because one person needs to be holding the probe or adjusting the probe to make sure that it's not gliding off the head, making sure that it's detecting signal all the time. And that is often not feasible and it's very like resource intensive.
Mm-hmm.
So subsequently, companies developed this tag that detects the oxygen level in the patient's brain that which we use in our research, where you can just stick on people's forehead, make sure it's secure with a tape that they yep. use in the ICU. And that's it. You just leave it on for 24 hours and you get rarely any missing signals.
Okay.
Yeah.
You mentioned 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
That's critical in the ICU
mm-hmm.
for a lot of things. They say, well, see how a patient's going to be in the next 24 hours. Is that waiting too long to help figure out the oxygen levels that this particular person should be getting?
That's a very good question. I think it could be, it totally could be. Early critical illness is essential to mm-hmm. their subsequent health in the ICU. And I think we're fortunate to know that in the research that look at this functional autoregulation, they're looking at the first 72 hours. So okay. if it takes you 24 hours to identify this blood pressure target, there's still 48 hours where you can do something.
To rectify.
To rectify or do something to improve and see if it does make a difference.
Okay.
And also the algorithm that we use right now do need several hours of recording in order to calculate the blood pressure.
Right. Which, makes sense.
How they interact. But I do think in the ideal world, and there's some research that's developing prototypes for that, it's real-time feedback.
Yes.
So you always record the blood pressure and other and oxygen level, and you adjust the target as times go. But those prototypes don't exist yet.
Right. But they could.
They could.
At least you're all thinking about it, knowing that we need to have a quicker result.
Exactly.
And it's still better than what you're doing now is still better than what it was before.
Exactly.
Where
exactly.
everyone was treated the same.
Exactly. And we're trying to research and see if different, I guess, time benchmarks are useful or not. we're recording for 24 hours and then we're targeting for 40 hours, mm-hmm. maybe this can be adjusted to 12 hours.
Right.
And then 12 hours of treatment and re-recording for 12 hours and then 12 hour treatment. So there's different paradigms that can be tested.
When people in the ICU, some of them, you know, they're going to be there because they've come in for electives. Well, it's not always elective surgery, but, you know, heart transplants and things. They know they're going in for that. Mm-hmm. Whereas a car accident, you never know when that's going to happen. So they just turn up. For those people who you know who are coming in, say, for elective surgery, the heart transplants and things, where you've got time beforehand, can you measure their blood pressure and things beforehand to give you an idea of what it should be post-surgery? Or is it really something that you really have to do post-surgery?
From what I read, I think this has to be something that you do post-surgery when okay. they're in the ICU.
Because your body's in more stress.
Exactly. And you're receiving different medications for when you're doing the surgery or before the surgery that could affect your cerebral regulation. And we just don't know. So I do think it has to be after the surgical procedure when individuals are in the ICU to do this recording and calculate their blood pressure. And I think that has been studied done before, correlating their optimal blood pressure post-surgery with during the surgery and even with their regular blood pressure before they enter the surgical OR. And they found that's not a predicting factor.
So it's not a predicting. Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? You want to try and predict what it needs to be at the moment.
Yeah, exactly.
So with all of that, because you've mentioned a lot of different things there, you know, looking at how blood pressure, a little bit about blood flow, but more about blood pressure, how it's getting to the brain, and then how you're trying to monitor it to make sure that you figure out the right levels that should be getting to the brain to reduce the risk of cognitive dysfunction. And then you've talked about calculations and things, and then this little gizmo that can help track all of this. What's the main part that you're working on? Because this is big picture. What's the main part that you're working on right now?
Yeah, thank you for this question. And it does get a little confusing because you have so many research.
Yes, because lots of people are doing different things. Yes,
exactly. And what the specific part I am looking at is whether we can rapidly identify people's blood pressure, optimal blood pressure, using the 24 hours, 40 hours paradigm. So recording for 24 hours, identify blood pressure, and maintaining them in their blood pressure range for the next 48 hours, and seeing what other challenges there are to this treatment protocol, and gathering some information on the preliminary clinical outcome.
And then post that, once you can gather this kind of information, what are you hoping to happen in the ICU moving forward?
I think it depends on what type of feasibility results we get.
Right.
We're trying to see if we can identify their optimal blood pressure in real time.
Yep.
And trying to maintain it with the medication that we already have in the ICU, norepinephrine and libidolol. So there are two types of blood pressure controlling medications.
Okay.
And we're trying to also see sort of the underlying question is, are these medications sufficient? Do we have enough human resources to make sure everybody's treatment is personalized? And any other barriers? Does the software function consistently? And if we're able to get the success rate that we've deemed acceptable, we'll move on with doing a larger randomized control study.
Are you getting results right now?
We're getting results right now.
That are showing that we can monitor okay and determined levels?
Yeah, so right now
I know it's only small, but yes.
Yeah, right now we're halfway through the study and we found that it's not an issue to identify people's optimal blood pressure.
Well, that's good.
The challenge comes with actually maintaining people in the individual range.
Right.
For some people, their range is very small.
Right, okay.
7-9 millimeter mercury. And it can be really hard for our nurses who are very understaffed in the ICU to constantly keep an eye on the individuals and maintain them in that range.
Right. So one, it's identifying, and two, it's continuing making sure they are in that range.
Yeah.
Which probably would fall on the nurse or something, correct?
Exactly, which will fall on our hardworking nurses.
Yes.
Who's taking care of multiple patients. And that's very important information to capture in the ICU, whether it's feasible or not. Currently, we're looking at if patients can be maintained with their range above 90% of the time.
Right.
When we're monitoring. That may not be feasible. but that's the question to ask. If it's 50%, 60%, mm-hmm. if it's 30% increase from their baseline from the first 24 hours of recording, is that still acceptable? I think these are the questions.
So what is acceptable? And then would someone in this study, not necessarily you, would somebody then, once you move further along in this, think about follow-up with these patients? Because it's one thing of trying to do the right thing while they're in hospital. But what happens when they go home? They may be functioning perfectly well while they're in hospital, but then they go home and get on with their normal life. And who knows, something else could have happened.
We do follow up with patients 3 months and 12 months after the discharge to see how they're recovering back home.
That's good.
And it is a hope that this intervention will be able to improve their cognitive outcome when they're back home.
So when you follow up, do you take, can you still go and take some oxygen levels of the brain just to see if it's still maintaining in with acceptable range?
We don't do that because the evidence is showing the cerebral autoregulation oxygen level early critical illness is associated with long-term cognitive outcome.
Okay, right.
So first few days in ICU is mm-hmm. really critical for
yep.
these neurological recovery.
It's an important one that you're doing, really important, because I imagine once you get more and better results and better ways of doing this, it's one more thing that though if any of us happen to be in an ICU or have a loved one in an ICU, for instance, we know there's one extra step that's being done now to have that person come out and still possibly live a good life.
Exactly. And you know, this is statistics from the research done in 2014. We know that 230,000 Canadians go to the ICU each year.
Oh, wow.
And at that time, they found that there was an increasing trend. It's a 12% increase from 2007, so from 4 years ago.
Right.
So I have no doubt that, you know, with the COVID pandemic and population growth, this number is increasing. Higher.
Mm-hmm.
And imagine, let's say the mortality rate in the ICU is about 20%. So 80% of patients do surviving their ICU stay. And half of them, so about 40% or 30%, have these cognitive impairment. That's a lot of Canadians.
That is a lot of Canadians.
A lot of Canadians every year that there needs to be something to make sure that they return home and they recover well and doesn't have to have their life interrupted
mm-hmm.
from this sort of negative consequence of critical illness.
One more question, which I didn't ask earlier. Are you finding right now, and I know everyone is an individual, but does age have a factor in people? So those in ICU who are later in years are finding it harder to regulate as opposed to younger ones. Or has it made no difference whatsoever? Is it a function of age or is it a function of what's happening in the ICU?
I think it can be so many things that makes age less predicting of a factor.
Okay.
If that makes sense. There has been research before that looked at whether demographic characteristics, things like age, gender, your reason of being admitted to the ICU and your other comorbidities you may have is predicting of your optimal blood pressure range.
Right.
And they found that none of the individual factor is predicting because there's so many different factors that interact with each other. So that's sort of where the research is at right now. And individuals who are older are more likely to have worse cognitive outcome after their discharge from the ICU. Because they
always say,
mm-hmm.
having an operation later in life, mm-hmm. there's a lot more complications, potential complications.
The other thing to account for, I guess, is frailty. Our hospital, the Kingston General Hospital, does a lot of research about frailty and how that impacts outcome. And it is a significant predictor. And as you get older, you become less mobilized and mm-hmm. you're just more frail in body function. And that also predicts how you recover afterwards. But that's sort of a different topic.
Different topic. So in terms of your research, you're doing some fabulous work and clearly there's a lot more that needs to be done, like a bigger study, et cetera. But it looks like you're all going on the right direction. Anything that can help in the ICU and, as you mentioned, make the quality of life post-ICU to be a good one.
Exactly.
It's got to be quite heartwarming for everyone who may end up there at some stage.
Exactly. And I think it affects, like you said, it's critical illness can affect everyone, Not saying that it should.
Yeah.
Not saying that it should.
But it can.
But, you know, I've known someone in my life, not my immediate family members, but, you know, my friend's grandparents who had to have surgery and ended up in the ICU. And, you know, I do think it's important that we see that as sort of the standard of care, that it's not just care in the ICU. And I think it's widely recognized now. It's not just about we making sure they survive their critical illness and that's it. We're doing everything we can to make sure that they not only survive, but they continue return home to their families, return to work, to support their living, and return to their enjoyable activities so they don't experience mental distress or feeling of isolation or feeling like lack of independence. They're all very, very important. Because then we're moving to an existential question about, you know, what does living well really mean?
Yeah.
And I think to a lot of people, this means not just being able to breathe and being really enjoying what's happening and having that health to be able to embrace and fully take in everything that's happening around you.
Yeah.
And when I reflect...
Being in control of it.
Being in control of it. And I was doing research about this. I also listened to a lot of patient stories as well. And there was one really stick with me. It was sort of a younger individual who... He wasn't an ICU survivor, but he had moderate traumatic brain injury.
Right.
And what I think was really upsetting and heartbreaking for me is, you know, he realizes that there's something wrong about the way his brain is working.
Right.
He realizes that there's something changing about the way he's seeing, his reasoning. He feels like there's something missing about himself. And also his loved ones seeing that he's becoming less and less like who he was before.
And it must be hard knowing you're going through that.
Exactly. And it's hard for everybody to feel like their body is uncontrollably changing and declining. And especially, I think the brain is, you know, it's a crucial part of our identity and who we are.
Yeah.
And that's why I think cognitive impairment and cognitive decline is such an important issue to making sure that everyone, whether it is aged gracefully or feels protected for any accidental thing that can happen in their life and that leads them to critical illness.
Well, I think that's a good place to stop. I mean, I know I could keep going and going because there's so much I could keep asking you, you know, can this be translated into other areas, da, 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 da. But we don't have time for that, unfortunately. So, Jaila, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really do appreciate it. And thank you for enlightening us about possible ways to make, if you have to go to the ICU, a lot better for you in the long term. So thank you very much for showcasing that for us.
For sure. My pleasure.
Thank you. Very good. Okay, so that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC Podcasts. Just type in Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray.
This September, KPP Concerts presents a stacked lineup of shows at the Broom Factory featuring everything from big-name acts to local gems. On September 12th, check out punk legends DOA with opening sets by The Meringues and Owl Farm. On September 13th, Kingston's own Oak Ridge Avenue hits the stage with Ottawa Rockers, The New Hires. On September 14th, pop punk and emo cover band Strike Tyson will play alongside local acts Sonic Souvenir and Squid Pistol. September 15th, folk singer Katie Tupper will play a matinee with Kingston's own Luella opening the show. On September 16th, punk heavyweights Authority Zero and Belvedere with special guests Melon Ball are performing. On September 18th, the legendary Martha Wainwright plays live in Kingston. On September 20th, local rockers Cassador return to the Broom Factory with Sparrow Blue. On September 21st, Nova Scotia's Mo Kenny will play a show. And on September 28th, don't miss Virginia to Vegas with special guest Alex Porat. For more information and to buy tickets, visit kppconcerts.com.
Z. CFRC 101.9 FM has opened applications for its 2024-2025 Musicians in Residence program. Young and emerging artists are encouraged to apply to use CFRC studio space as an incubator to create new music, perform it live on air with video simulcast, take part in industry-related workshops for bands who are just starting out, and get paid. Learn more and apply today at CFRC.ca.
Kick your shoes off at the door.
Over the last three seasons, the Queens Gaels have had the Ottawa GG's number. These teams have played seven times since 2021, and Queens has walked away victorious on all seven occasions. For each of the last 3 years, Ottawa's season has ended at Richardson Memorial Stadium. But with every game played, the margin of victory gets tighter and tighter. In 2023, the Gaels won their two matchups by 7 total points. On Saturday, September 14th, the two Titans of the OUA East rekindle their rivalry once more as the Gaels make the short trip up the 416 to play the GGs in Ottawa. Will the Gaels make it an elite 8 in a row, or will the GGs finally snap their post-pandemic losing streak? Tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM at 2:45 for the pregame show ahead of the 3 p.m. kickoff. We hope to see you then.
Cego
Buju Anin
Danach A Tak Anzeni Shukwithan
Tanse
Ay Inuhalikai.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Tanse, hello, and welcome to Words and Culture. You may be used to hearing from January Rogers in this space, but we're now moving on to the Cree language episodes, where I will be your host for the next 6 shows. My name is Michael Hutchinson. I'm a First Nation member of Treaty 5, which mostly exists in the Interlake region of Manitoba. My family is Swampy Cree and comes from the community of Missipuistic. In the coming episodes on Cree, we'll be traveling to my home community to meet my auntie. We'll also meet a famous Cree musician from Northwestern Ontario, and we're going to talk NHL hockey in Cree. Full disclosure, I am not fluent in my language, and that is one of the greatest embarrassments of my life, but we'll be talking with some of my guests about that in the episodes coming up. There are 5 major dialects in Cree, with many micro-dialects that come from different landscapes and Cree communities. We're going to talk about those differences and similarities and where in Canada they are. But now I want to introduce you to my first guest, Grand Chief Garrison Satie of the Manitoba Kiwatinoyoga Mackinac, or MKO. Garrison is a great guy, and he's not just a political leader, he's also a former educator and an amazing musician and singer who puts on a great classic rock show. Another disclosure, I used to work at MKO, but before Garrison became Grand Chief. The MKO represents just over 24 First Nations in northern Manitoba. I caught up with Garrison at the offices of the Manitoba Kiwatinoyoga Mackinac. Tanse, how you doing?
Good.
Good, good. I'm here to see the Grand Chief. I might be a little early.
I don't think he's here. Or is he here? Grand Chief here? Okay. Naomi, is it Michael?
Yes.
You can hang with.
I heard his voice.
Okay.
Yeah, I recognized his voice.
All right.
Good to see you, Grand Chief.
Oh, Tanse.
I always love your hugs.
Iminiten ewap mitaguk epetataguk bicheto. Nasus iminiten egeneni tamanistani pigiskuven. I just said that I'm very happy that I speak my language, and I was taught the Cree language when I was very young. Of course, my parents spoke Cree, and my siblings and I speak Cree to each other all the time because that's the language we were raised in, and it's a language I'm most comfortable with.
Okay.
And when I speak in Cree, I speak from my heart. Because when I speak in English, which is my second language, I have to do this thing in my head, right? Try to make that translation from what I understand in Cree into English. And sometimes it's a challenge to do that, because sometimes what you say in English doesn't really make sense, or it sometimes sounds funny.
Yeah. What dialect do you speak?
I'm Swampy Cree.
The best Cree.
The best Cree. Yes.
What are the other dialects in Cree?
Well, there's the Plains Cree.
Yeah.
And there's the Mistissini Cree, and then there's a Rock Cree, and
Woodland?
Woodland Cree, yes. Brochet, Nelson, how's that?
Yeah.
Woodland.
And then out in Quebec, I think it's Atikamekw Cree.
Atikamekw Cree, Mistissini Cree, there's James Bay Cree.
Yeah. So there's about five different, big dialects.
Yeah.
But then there's also each community can have little differences
in
how they speak.
Especially in my community of Kamishikamak, the north end and the south end have their own dialects.
You're kidding.
The sound, the intonation is different. And you can tell which part of town somebody's from when they speak Cree. Yeah, especially when we were younger. And there was a little bit of a rivalry, who's right and who's wrong and how they say things. And same thing with our neighbors.
Yeah.
Norway House, it's a lot of different ways they say things. And even the accent is very different. So it's the accents, the dialect that makes it very different.
Yeah.
But, I used to teach Cree at one time in Cranberry Portage.
You've been a teacher for a long time.
Yeah, I was a teacher for many years.
Yeah.
And I had to teach Cree at Frontier School Division in Cranberry Portage. They've never had a Cree program there before. I was the one that taught it for the first time when I was working there. And I can honestly say that I thought I knew my Cree, because when you start doing the research and also thinking of how to say things, it made it very, I learned more.
Okay.
And my grandfather never spoke a word of English in his life. So I benefited from that exchange with him when I was growing up. And I would have to learn how to say things in a way that he would understand them. So that gave me the ability to be more conversant with my language, and also learning the formal way of saying things as opposed to just everyday terminology.
There's sort of like a new Cree and an old Cree, almost like there's New English and Elizabethan English.
Absolutely. Like there's the old Cree, they call it the old Cree, or high Cree, some people call it high Cree, but the old Crees, where the language is so rich that they don't take shortcuts in the pronunciation. It's like consonant, vowel, consonant, vowel. For example, when I say tansi, our people say tanisi, tanisi. They don't say tansi.
Yeah.
So that's the old way of speaking. And instead, when I say no much, but the old people, my grandfather was saying namats. So they didn't shorten these words. But now there's a breakdown in some of the words, and it become less formal, and the people have lost the old ways of saying things. And that's because of the contact we have with the outside world. We started utilizing words and combining them into Cree and English at the same time. Like, for example, when you say bread, people say burret. Barret, but it's an English word, they Creeify it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Or if they say skulik at the school, then school is an English word combined with the Cree.
Yeah, yeah. Betsy.
Like that, eh? Yeah. And also there's also the people call it Kringlish, right?
Okay.
Because of their contact with outside, people become more inclined to speak both languages at the same time. But I'm fortunate that I'm around people that are very fluent. Mm. And my grandfathers spoke very high Cree, and I was fortunate enough to be exposed to that. And I still value, and I'm still learning to this day. I sometimes phone up people that I know that have a command of the language. The language keepers that we have are so few, but they're still out there,
yeah.
And they're still teaching.
Yeah.
And I think that more than ever, we need to hold them in high regard because of the preservation of the language, because of the young people losing the language and not learning it. We're in danger of losing the language in our communities because it's happening. When I went back to teach in my First Nation, Pimichigamak, I was surprised when I was outside in the playground, I would see the kids still and hear the kids still speaking to Cree, yeah. In Cree to each other, sir. And then that 20 years later, you don't hear that much.
Yeah.
Well, there's an idea in Cree, it sort of goes through the whole language, the idea of inanimate and animate. Can you explain that?
Well, I think that, as indigenous people, everything has a spirit. That's why sometimes you call inanimate things as if though they were living, like a rock.
Yeah.
You speak to it like it's a living thing. It's not something that's not alive. And in our culture, of course, everything has a spirit, right?
Yeah.
And that's where a lot of people in the outside of our culture don't see it like that. Everything is strictly black and white. For us, these objects or things have life and they have a spirit. That's why you can call them as if they were a living being, as animate.
Yeah. Well, and so it's like French, where in French, everything is split up into male and female, masculine, feminine. In Cree, everything is split up into that which has spirit and that which does not have spirit.
Absolutely. That is the difference.
Yeah. And does it create a philosophy, do you think?
Absolutely. And it's embedded in our blood memory, right? It's something that we carry with us, and those of us that speak our language, there's things we say without really thinking about it, but we're actually promoting that philosophy because it's ingrained in us, and our parents and our grandparents spoke to these things, and nothing was written down.
Yeah.
Like the Cree that I learned was never from a textbook. It was never in a course. It was never in a classroom. It's just hearing it and being spoken to in that language from ever since you were an infant. Mm-hmm. And even in your mother's womb,
yeah,
you heard reverberations of this language and even some of the songs that you heard in our language.
Yeah.
So it's something that you are exposed to, and you're conditioned in that language in such a powerful way. And then I say things and speak things as if I knew beforehand what I'm going to say, but yet I don't, yet it comes out, right?
Yeah.
It's an amazing language because it's a spiritual language.
Yeah.
It is a spiritual language. Language is a spiritual language. Cree is a spiritual language along with all the other indigenous languages.
Why do you think Cree parents today aren't teaching their kids Cree?
I think because, number one, they don't have contact with their child as much as our parents did, because most of the parents, mothers, would stay at home and be working at home, and they would have that contact with their children.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they would speak to them in Cree. But nowadays, most parents, because of, challenges of the economic situation, they have to work, both parents have to work. So the child is at school.
Yeah.
And especially technology, movies, music, it's all in English. And that's what they're exposed to.
Yeah.
And I think that parents really have to push themselves to make sure that their language is being passed on to their children. And even the grandparents don't communicate, or the kids don't communicate with the grandparents as much as they used to.
Mm-hmm.
Like for us, everybody, our aunties and uncles, lived around us in the same area. Our grandparents would be there. So everybody spoke the language all around you, and you had no choice but to learn. And you spoke it. And but nowadays, there's so much family. The family dynamics have changed. Even on the reserve, people don't live together anymore. Relatives don't live in the same neighborhood, but they're scattered because of the way housing is allocated. And it's all over. And then because of...
Interesting. I never thought of it.
Yeah, and then because of shortage of housing, they'll go anywhere just to get a house. And even there's an area that their family has never lived. Like, there's a connection to which part of the community lived in that when I was growing up. But now there's no real connection. It's just everybody goes everywhere. So that I think that impacted the language.
Yeah. Well, and aunties and uncles, you know, and grandparents were so crucial to raising the children, to disciplining the child.
Absolutely.
You know, in comparison to, say, the nuclear family in what many people are living today.
Yeah, like, you know, it's it was normal for my uncles to get after me if I were doing something wrong or saying something wrong. And it was normal for us to get reprimanded by our aunties, and if we're doing things that were probably causing... making trouble with different people. I mean, I think that the family responsibility, I mean, the whole family responsible for their children, not just their own, but their nieces and nephews, is a role that they fulfilled.
Yeah. Well, like we mentioned earlier, you are an educator. So what are some of the problems with, you know, nowadays there's a lot of parents that are, I don't want to downplay the importance of educators or people, you know, working to have Cree in the schools, but it is different than learning at home. So what are some of the challenges those educators are facing starting kids in kindergarten rather than right from birth?
I think because we're using a Western approach to try to teach the language. We're using a Westernized methodology to try to promote the language. And I think it has, to some extent, some impact. But an elder took me aside one day and he says, it's good what you're doing in the school with the language. It's good. I just wanted to say that that's not how we were taught. It says we were taken out on the land, and we were taken out to do things, trap, hunt, fish, camp. And that's where you heard the language instruction.
Yeah.
Basic commands like, api, sit down. Hastam.
Yeah.
Pirite, come. And then that's how we learned, eh? Uta astanima, put that over there. So you, by action, right? And then I think that what I'm getting at is land-based and also immersion are one of those things that are the most appropriate way of teaching our language, land-based, because you're working with the land, on the land, and you're immersed in language where an elder that may not speak English, you're there and you're forced to learn to respond and say things.
Yeah.
And then that's why we don't really have I don't think your attention in the schools is really that much because, and I've said this before in the language conference, kids will do anything just to get that credit, to get it out of the way.
Mm.
They don't have an appreciation of what they learned. They just want that credit. Get done with this.
Okay.
So what I need to do to graduate? Okay, next is, you know, other courses. But so it's not treated as something that is cultural. It's an academic. Mm. It's an academic thing. It's something that's just forced on you.
Yeah. Where, you know, like you mentioned, going out on the land, like new experience with those new experiences, say hunting versus trapping, you know, or trapping versus fishing or picking berries, you'd be doing new stuff. And so you would have to learn new words. You'd be engaging with new plants, new animals. And so you would have to learn new stuff.
Yep. And then that's when you start to ask, what is this? Kegonuma. And then you'd get the answer from the elder, right? Kegonuma. And then also thinking, what are these? Okay, And there's different kinds of trees, there's different kinds of birds, there's different kinds of plants and flowers. So you start asking, what are those things, right?
Yeah.
And then you're there, and you can smell the flower, you can feel the flower, touch the flower. That's what makes it more effective, because you're there on the land. You're not just looking at it in a black and white picture.
Yeah.
You don't really have the full understanding of that word, what it means, because it's in a book. But then when you see it, you feel it, and you smell it, and even taste it, the berries, right? It's alive.
With all this in mind, what would you like to see in the future? Like, to you, what does a healthy Cree language look like?
I think that it should be a normal practice for families. It starts with the family. The families have to commit to teach their children the language. They have to
commit themselves.
Yeah, value. And I have one of my brothers talks to their grandson in Cree only. And I've seen videos of them. They just speak in Cree, and the little child understands and does what he's told in Cree. And I'm thinking, there is hope for this generation. There is hope for that language to still be passed on. And the little kid will run to the fridge and get that. And then he asks to open that lid. He does it. And then kipa, and he closes it. And then on the nasta, and he does that. I think it was 1.5 years old. Mm. Already listening to those, because he's in an environment where he hears it and listens to it and acts upon it. And that's the thing, is creating an environment in the home. And I had I read an article in Maclean magazine some years back, where the former Prime Minister Pierre Elliott Trudeau, in his home, there's three levels, but on that one floor, only French is spoken. Mm. And a designated area, only French is spoken. And I'm thinking of that in my own way of what if the schools, this is a designated area for Cree speaking only. And if you're going to be here, you only speak Cree. That will, you know, I think that exercise, I think they will be more, I guess, susceptible to learn and hear the language in those environments. And we have to create those spaces and environments for people. And I think that people that speak the language need to speak it more. Like even my colleagues, I know they speak Cree. I speak Cree. But because we're in a professional environment, we speak to each other in English. And I think that we need to make an effort to just speak Cree whenever we can. And I think that's a healthy way of preserving the language and also promoting the language. And I think preserving and promoting are two things that we need to do. And having spaces where only Cree is spoken, that's what we need to do in workplaces, especially with an indigenous organization. Yeah. Ojibwe here, Cree here, Dakota here, yeah. Ojibwe here.
So, you know, how does it make you feel when you see a young person like your nephew there speaking Cree?
I feel very emotional. I feel very proud. It does something to me inside when I see that a child that young understands the language spoken to him. It's sort of like a healing that's taking place. It's a healing, because our languages have been assaulted, and our languages have been banned, but yet to see that it's still alive, it's just inspiring.
Now, in each episode, we're going to take some time to learn a few words in Cree. I asked Grand Chief Garrison to teach me some cool concepts or words in Cree, so let's hear what he's got to teach.
Okay, one thing is to promote self-esteem, right?
Okay.
That was like, kimino na pewin.
Kimino mo.
Ke.
Mino. Mino.
Na pewin.
Na pewin.
You're a good man. And I say that from my heart, because I'm recognizing who you are, and I'm saying it in my language. Kimino na pewin.
Kinim.
Mino.
Kin.
Ke.
Meno
Napewin. Napew is man.
Okay.
Kimino Napewin. You are a good man.
Excellent.
Aba kisakitin. Kisakitin.
Kisakitin.
I love you or I care for you.
Excellent.
Those are very important words to affirm.
Yeah.
And kikisken itaman.
Kikisken.
Itaman.
Itaman. Kikisken. Itaman.
You are a smart person.
Okay.
So I'm, speaking things that are true in your life, but you need to hear them.
Well, I appreciate you telling that to me, because not too many people do.
Yeah, and that's true. We need to celebrate people's characters and gifts and honor those gifts.
Okay. Well, just to wrap up here, too, on every episode, we're going to play a song. Do you have a favorite Cree song?
There's a few Cree songs I know. Winston Watini sings a song called Ninistosin. Ninistosin, Ninistosin, Kono, Kono, Tekiwean, Ninistosin, Wahaya,
Excellent. Well, we'll see if we can find that, or we can get Winston to do it for us.
Absolutely.
And, we'll make sure we'll play
it. Cool.
Okay, well, I want to say goodbye. I want to thank you for all that you've done, for the teachings that you've given, from the compliments you've given me as well. Mm-hmm. And is there anything you wanted to say to wrap up?
Let's speak Cree. Any chance we have to speak Cree, promote it. I always start off in Cree whenever I address any crowd, because that's my language, and I'm proud of it, and I promote it, and we just have to encourage one another. Let's speak Cree.
So that was my conversation with Garrison Satie, the Grand Chief of the Manitoba Kiwatinohi Ogamakanak. During our chat, Garrison sang a bit of a song by Cree musician Winston Watney. I caught up with Winston recently and asked if he would play Kayas Neheyo.
Kayas Neheyo Gipa Pompidou.
ski me wasin, ski.
I